36. For a moment, Corey remained frozen, dimly conscious of the evening breeze on her face, the hum of traffic on I-25. Then she turned, ran back up the stairs, re-entered the building, and passed through the barrier. Shady had just finished scanning her exit slip and was filing it away. He looked at her in concern.
Is there a problem?
Corey made an effort to seem nonchalant.
No problem. I was just curious about something you said. On Friday, Agent Morwood left the office at 5 p.m.?
Let me clear this screen.
A few more finger taps, then Shady peered closely at the monitor.
Yep, 5:01 exactly.
Then how was he found in the lab after the fire? That didn't take place until after midnight.
He came back.
This was not unexpected.
What time was that?
Late. Shoot, it was only 3 days ago. You'd think I'd recall.
A brief pause while he looked up the details.
Checked in at 11:50.
And he went straight back to his office?
No, miss. He signed in for the lab.
The lab?
Got it right up here on the screen.
Was he carrying anything?
A blue evidence box with a tag.
Did he often come back to work late at night?
Not usually. He stayed late plenty of times, now and then real late. But once he left, he was gone until morning.
Corey did her best to look mildly curious, but her mind was racing.
You were on duty that night, weren't you?
I'm like a Swiss watch. Monday to Friday, 8 p.m. until 4 in the a.m.
So were you...
She wasn't quite sure how to put this tactfully.
The first to learn of the fire?
That was Harold Lamson.
Harold Lamson? Who's he?
Night maintenance. He was working down by the far end of the main building when the alarm went off.
When was this?
Must have been shortly before 1. He called me. I called the fire department, Mr. Garcia, then emergency response, in that order.
You said the far end of the main building?
Shady nodded.
Seems strange, doesn't it? An alarm going off that far from the fire, I mean? They tell me that lab's pretty airtight. I didn't smell any smoke up here, that's for certain.
And once you called for help?
That's all she wrote. Way I heard it, the fire had more or less burned itself out by then.
He shrugged.
Thanks so much.
Corey made a show of heading once again for the exit, then paused one more time.
Damn, she said, turning. You know, I left some files I wanted to review in my desk. Just locked them away and walked out.
It's been that kind of a day, I'll bet.
I suppose I have to fill out another pass?
She asked meekly. Shady hesitated.
Guess so, miss. Especially now.
He handed one through the barrier screen.
Sorry.
It's my own fault.
She filled in every detail, including her destination, Section 2G. Then she signed at the bottom and passed it back.
Thanks.
No problem at all.
She began to walk back toward the stairs, then stopped.
Oh, Shady, don't be surprised if I'm a couple of minutes. I also have a little work to finish up.
Very good, Miss Swanson.
She walked away from the security barrier and across the lobby to the stairwell, then turned the corner, hearing the echo of her low heels in the empty space. Once out of sight of the guard station, she slipped off her shoes. Instead of turning left up the stairs, she took another look around, listened to make sure all was silent, then made for the stairway leading down to the basement. The lab wasn't far from the foot of the stairs. Investigators had taped a large security tarp at one side of the stairwell. She slipped behind that, crouched, then descended as quickly and silently as she could. There was a security camera at the bottom of the stairs. but she was banking on being concealed by the tarp and other debris she could see piled below, wrapped in evidence bags. At the bottom of the stairs, she slunk around the corner, then paused. There were no warning shouts from above, no footfalls of Shady coming to investigate. Keeping behind the investigative tarp that lined one side of the hall, she headed for the door to the lab. The tarp ended in a taped seal just beyond the lab entrance. The door itself was closed and covered with crime scene tape. Corey was able to duck beneath it with ease. The security keypad was dark, disabled. She turned the safety handle carefully, unlocked, and then, as quietly as she could, fearing at any moment some maintenance person or late worker would come around the corner, pushed the door open just enough to slip inside. Beyond was nothing but blackness. Even the exit signs were off, and she was almost overwhelmed by an acrid odor of smoke, melted plastic, burnt electronics, and something else she didn't care to identify. She raised herself to full height, pushing the door closed behind her. Then, reaching into her bag, she located her Surefire Defender, pulled it out, and snapped it on. The 1,000-lumen LED bulb illuminated a damp, hellish landscape. She directed the beam toward her feet, but not before noticing that the lab's lone security camera was partly burnt, covered by more security tape, and half disassembled. At least she didn't have to worry about being seen inside. She switched off the flashlight and stood motionless in the dark, catching her breath. What the hell was she doing here anyway? But she knew the answer even before she'd asked herself the question. On Saturday, and again today, her eyes had darted more than once toward the basement stairs. Both Garcia and Agent Lime had told her she had nothing to worry about. But that was just talk. She couldn't leave it alone. She couldn't wait for however long the investigation might take to release a report. She had to know if she was responsible for Morwood's death. She had to know now. But even beyond that, she wondered why Morwood had come back to the lab at midnight on a Friday. What was so pressing that he couldn't wait until morning? She had to hurry. This had been an impulsive decision on her part. And if she was caught, she would be in deep shit, especially since she was a potential suspect. Christ, she had to finish and get out before she lost her nerve. She turned her light on once again and shined it around. She was used to seeing a long, narrow hallway, made narrower by the rows of boxes and packing materials Lathrop never seemed to clear away. Now, however, only ruin lay ahead of her. Charred piles of ash and half-burnt, unidentifiable things, sodden and sunken in on themselves and coated with foam retardant. Above them, soot streaks curled up the walls and across the ceiling, bizarre and clutching, like silhouettes from a German expressionist film. All around her were little numbered flags, some red, some yellow, some blue. And on the floor directly before her was a particularly heavy swarm of flags that, she realized in sudden horror, formed the outline of a human being. Stifling a gasp and looking away, she passed by this quickly, staying close to the ashen boxes that lined the wall, their contents now exposed. The Bunsen burner was her objective. She had to examine it and get out. She turned the corner, placing her feet with care, and the beam of her light fell across the main lab. She quickly aimed it toward the soapstone table on which the burner sat, and there it was, scorched but intact, and turned off. Thank God! The rubber hose was unhitched, and her light played on the valve, which was also turned off. Of course, one of the investigators might have turned it off, but that seemed unlikely. They would have shut down the gas farther back and left everything inside the lab as undisturbed as possible until their work was complete. Embarrassed at her overwhelming and selfish sense of relief, she let her light drift over the rest of the lab. A platoon of flamethrowers couldn't have done a more thorough job. Storage cabinets hung loose from the walls, glass fronts melted. Cabinets that had been full of papers and evidence were now just shapeless lumps of steel and carbon. The lockers that held the two sets of human remains had burst open under the heat, ghastly as crematoria, the evidence inside thoroughly burnt. And the table where she'd worked so hard on her facial reconstructions no longer existed. It was just a low pile of broken metal, covered, like everything else, with tiny evidence flags. It was as Agent Lime had told her. All the evidence, everything she'd been working on, was gone. And Lathrop was as full of shit as she'd expected. The fire wasn't her fault. She'd better get the hell out. This was crazy. She couldn't afford to spend any more time here. Not even a minute. As she turned to leave, her light passed over something lying on the floor, in a melted evidence box, that gleamed dully. It was the device Morwood had brought back to the lab from his visit to Eastchester. Was that why he was there? If so, why wait until midnight? He would have been back from Los Alamos no later than 9:30 or 10. She peered at it more closely. It was heavily blackened by smoke, but otherwise intact. On impulse, she took her phone from her pocket and, leaning forward so as not to leave footprints in a layer of sodden ash and rivers of plastic, took pictures of the device, top, sides, and bottom, where the legend and some numbers had been stamped. Walking gingerly, she reached the door, opened it slightly, made sure nobody was in the hall beyond, and slipped out. 37. Nora woke to the smell of bacon and eggs and the sound of Skip's usual morning conversation with Mitty, who listened with great attention and zero comprehension. As she came out of her bedroom, Skip, without turning around, said,
"Bet you slept soundly."
"Now, why would you say that?" Nora asked, sitting down while Skip placed a latte in front of her.
"Well," he said cheerily, "when you came in rather late last evening, you looked like you'd just run a marathon, all pink-cheeked and glowing."
"Please shut up," Nora said, and buried her lips in the warm foam, taking a deep draw of coffee.
"I figured you worked up quite an appetite, too."
She was, in fact, starving, but said nothing, her annoyance rising. A moment later, Skip placed a plate of bacon and eggs in front of her. She tucked in right away, hoping she could finish and get out of there before he said more.
"You know, sis, I really like Lucas. He's a good guy. He could have raked me over the coals for holding out on him about Baton, but he didn't."
"You're lucky, that's all I can say."
"I'd like to think it's because I've proven to be an important member of the team," Skip said with a note of injured pride.
"That's true," said Nora. And it was. Skip had risen to the occasion. Not only had he grown surprisingly knowledgeable about UAPs and become able to carry on deep conversations with the scientists, but he was curating the collection of artifacts well and keeping the library and archives in good shape. He had learned a lot in his time analyzing potsherds at the Institute. Skip placed another plate down for himself.
"Can I ask how serious this thing is with Tappan? Is it really that obvious that we're, you know, having a relationship?" "Are you kidding? You go in there supposedly for some quick meeting and come back out 2 hours later, blooming. Yeah, it's kind of obvious."
Nora felt a wave of dismay. Of course, Skip was right, and in an ant farm like this, everybody would notice.
"Are people talking?" "Not to me, but I'm sure they're yakking it up among themselves."
Oh, God. It was a stupid thing they were doing, both for her and for Tappan. Yet, once again, a part of her just didn't care. It had been several years since Bill had died. She felt like something inside her was coming back to life, roaring back, in fact. At the same time, it was improper, inappropriate, and just plain reckless. Even more important, she had to be careful not to let her feelings cloud her professional judgment and her objectivity. For example, she couldn't let Lucas's zealous belief in UFOs influence her own opinions. On the other hand, life was short, and it was so much fun. Skip laid a hand on her hand, suddenly serious.
Nora, you're not going to let yourself get hurt, are you? I mean, Tappan must have a million girls chasing him. Those dimples and gray eyes and all that money. I think it's great you're having a little amuse-bouche. You certainly deserve it. But I don't want to see it go wrong.
It won't. Even as she said it, she had to admit to herself she'd fallen into the deep end of the pool. Where it was going, she had no idea, and she figured the best thing was to avoid thinking about it. It had only been 2 days, after all. They were both adults and knew what they were doing, or so she told herself.
Okay, enough said.
Skip glanced at his watch.
Almost 8. Time for yet another meeting.
They arrived at Quonset 1 a few minutes later. Banks had set up a digital projector and screen, and they all took seats. Tappan was already there, and as soon as everyone was seated, he rose.
The LIDAR survey came in around 5 this morning, he said. Vitali, put it up.
The lights darkened and an image flashed onto the screen. A grayscale map of the landscape in incredible detail. Tappan said nothing further, and the image hung there silently in the darkness. Nora leaned forward, staring. She saw it almost immediately. An old disturbance in the Gigantes Valley. The faint ghost of a road that went into the valley and ended in a circle. A large area, strangely blurred from this height, with nearly invisible tracks crisscrossing each other in the middle of the circle. It sure looked like an old crash site, covered up and undisturbed for decades. An excited babble of voices rose in the room as everyone else saw it.
A picture is worth 1,000 words, Tappan finally said. And this one represents good news and bad. The good news is this must be the real crash site. They covered it up as best they could, and time has done its work. But nothing is invisible to LIDAR. You can clearly see the scars even after all these years. The bad news is that all those old tracks and disturbances indicate the government found it long ago.
He looked around.
Any questions?
What's that mark going through the upper corner of the image?
Banks asked.
Is that a road?
Kuznetsov answered.
Yes, it's not on our maps, but then there are a lot of old ranch roads that were never put on maps. I don't think it has any relevance.
Could that be where Baton got picked up?
Banks continued.
It's possible, said Kuznetsov. But at first glance, the track doesn't look like it's seen any fresh traffic. We haven't examined it in detail.
Thank you, said Tappan.
Nora, your turn.
Nora stood up. She looked around the table but didn't detect any knowing smirks.
As soon as we grade a road to the site, we'll transfer our equipment and proceed with immediate excavation. All indications are that this is where the, object landed after the skip site, and was then, perhaps, retrieved by the government.
How long will it take to build the road?
Banks asked.
We can almost drive there now, cross-country. There are just a few small sections that need equipment to grade a safe passage for the jeeps. We'll have to skirt those grassy hills, but that's not a big deal. We should be able to complete a rough road in less than a day.
How far is it from here?
Vihil asked.
About 8 miles.
And how long will the excavation take?
Kuznetsov asked.
We don't know how deep we need to go,
said Nora. But it looks like ground similar to here. I would guess a week or even less. It's a more compact site. By the way, just to be safe, I've reviewed our permits. We're clear to proceed. All we have to do is report the change of venue to the Department of the Interior. As she sat down again, she was aware of a strange dynamic in the room. Everyone was clearly excited by this discovery. On the other hand, there was every reason to believe the government had gotten there first. But gotten there and done what? She just wasn't willing to accept it was some alien UFO. She even felt, ironically enough, her skepticism reasserting itself, as if in reaction to her feelings for Tappan. After all, it could have been an advanced missile, or an unusual meteorite, or an experimental aircraft, any one of which could have been retrieved by the government and the site then covered up. But she didn't mention any of this. And when there were no further questions, Tappan adjourned the meeting. 38. Watts eased his sheriff's vehicle down the road through the cottonwood trees until the view suddenly opened up to reveal a broad sandy beach, and beyond, the braided ribbon of the Rio Grande. The sun was just rising over the river, turning it into molten gold. He brought the explorer to a halt, powering down the windows and turning off the engine. He reached into the back and removed a coffee carrier. He handed Corey a giant lidded cup and a foil-wrapped burrito.
Coffee and breakfast, as promised.
Sitting in the passenger seat, Corey gingerly accepted them, spread some napkins in her lap, and took a grateful slug of coffee, noting the extra cream and sugar. As if reading her thoughts, Watts said,
I remembered how you like it, sweet and thick.
Corey had expected breakfast in a cafe, not this. This was, she thought, more like a, well, a breakfast date. She quickly pushed the thought out of her mind. FBI agents did not date county sheriffs, especially over breakfast.
When I was a kid, we used to ride our horses down here, Watts said. It's one of my favorite places. We waded across the river and rode into the Bosque de la Patria, that giant grove of cottonwoods on the other side. You being recent to New Mexico, he continued, I thought you might like to see it.
He was talking fast, uncharacteristically nervous for such a laid-back guy. It's beautiful, Corey said. I'm glad you brought me here. And it really was beautiful, even magical, with the whispering sounds of the river, the sun shining through the cottonwoods, the distant purple mountains. She looked over at him, seeing his relief that she wasn't bored. It would be easy to dismiss a man this young as a cliché, she knew, with the six guns and holsters and expensive cowboy hat. But like an iceberg, Watts had a lot more to him than you could see at first glance. She took another long sip of coffee and a bite of her burrito, listening to him talk.
Bosque del Apache means Apache Grove. It's called that because the Warm Springs Apache used to camp there in the old days. Some of the biggest cottonwood trees you'll ever see can be found over there. Trunks 30 feet in circumference. They go on for miles. And in those sand hills behind the forest is a lost Pueblo city called Senecu. The ruins were visible until the 18th century, when it was totally covered with windblown sand. Now its location is forgotten.
Corey couldn't help but be impressed by his deep affection for the land and its history. They continued their breakfast in silence for a while as the sun climbed higher in the sky.
I guess we'd better talk shop, said Watts, since that's why you came down.
Right, said Corey, vaguely disappointed.
I spoke to Buford about the case. It seems pretty straightforward. He thinks Baton walked off the job and will eventually turn up. I tend to agree, especially considering those lights that were seen in the area where he disappeared.
Buford speculated Baton might have had some hidden agenda.
Corey hesitated. She wasn't so sure about that, but she didn't have evidence either way. And as Morwood had drilled into her, FBI agents never voiced hunches. But Watts sensed her doubt.
You don't agree?
Corey shrugged.
I agree the evidence points to him taking off, but it seems a strange way to do it, in the middle of the desert, leaving Nora's brother alone like that. Anyway, it's not my case.
Speaking of your case, this digging up the Roswell site sounds batshit crazy to me.
It is.
What can you tell me about it?
Corey wondered if it was kosher to share the details with him. She decided it was. She quickly sketched out the background, from Nora Kelly's involvement and the billionaire backing the project, to the double homicide they'd discovered, and finally, to Morwood's death in the fire. When she was done, a brief silence settled over the vehicle.
I read about Morwood's death in the journal,
Watts said at last.
That must have been pretty tough.
It was.
Corey, to her horror, heard her voice cracking just a little.
Hey, said Watts, placing a hand on her shoulder. Wow, it really did hit you hard. I'm so sorry I didn't call you.
Corey shook her head, mortified.
Why? We're colleagues. You don't owe me anything.
You reached out to me as a friend, I hope, not just a colleague, said Watts.
Corey brushed away a tear. This was getting ridiculous. In another moment, she'd be bawling.
I suppose I did. That came out wrong just now.
It's okay. I understand.
I'm sorry for falling apart like this.
She made a mighty effort to pull herself together.
I have to go over the autopsy results this afternoon, and that means having to view Morwood's body. I'm dreading it.
Don't go, then. You can get all the information you need from the report.
No, she said. I have to. I have to do this.
His hand remained on her shoulder, and he gave her a reassuring squeeze.
You know, I'm always here when you need me, as a colleague and a friend.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I really do.
She finally managed to get herself under control.
It's more than Morwood's death. The fire destroyed most of the crucial evidence in the case. I'd done a reconstruction of the victim's faces, and those were burned up along with the remains. And
she hesitated.
The pathology technician accused me of leaving a burner on.
What the? Like hell you did?
I didn't. And I know the fire investigation will show that. But it's been stressful.
I think it's remarkable you're handling it so well. Do you have anyone you can lean on in the FBI office?
I have a new mentor, Agent Lime. He's been really supportive.
I'm glad to hear that.
He paused.
You'll get through this, Corey. You've got an inner toughness, and I think you know that.
She nodded. She did know that. She was tough, and she would get through it.
We'd better get going. Thanks for your help with Buford. I really appreciate it.
Watts balled up their burrito foils, shoved them in the empty coffee cups, put it all in the bag, and started the Explorer.
I'll let you know how the case develops, but as I said, it's probably as banal as it seems. The guy just disappeared himself.
Corey nodded.
Thanks for showing me this special place.
Maybe we can get together for dinner sometime.
This had tumbled out abruptly, and the uncharacteristic nervousness had returned.
You mean, like, as in a date?
Well, you know, just to catch up. I'll fill you in on Buford's work.
Corey felt, not for the first time, a strange mix of excitement and anxiety rising within her.
I'd like that, she said. But let's make it lunch. Is that okay?
He nodded, the relaxed smile returning.
No problem.
And he eased the vehicle around and back down the sandy road. 39. Corey had seen many autopsies before, and this would be no different. Or so she kept telling herself. Lime had assured her several times it wasn't necessary for her to attend, that he could do it alone, and more than once she'd come close to canceling. But she felt it her duty to hear directly from the ME how Morwood had died. Struggling to control her apprehension, she and Lime arrived at the door of the FBI medical examiner's lab and were welcomed by the ME himself, a short, portly doctor named Boyd Mason. He led them into the brightly lit room, where a corpse lay on a gurney under a plastic sheet. His bustling, talkative manner was somehow reassuring. This was, she thought, the way to treat death, matter-of-factly, with a professional outlook. They were just dead bodies, nothing more, as inert as a tree trunk or a rock. Mason reached out and grabbed the corner of the sheet, then glanced up.
You've both seen autopsied cadavers before, of course.
They nodded, and he drew back the sheet. Instantly, the sight froze Corey with horror. Her gorge rose. She struggled mightily to control herself, but almost immediately realized it was going to be a losing fight.
If I might, sorry, excuse myself.
She stumbled into the adjacent restroom. Thank God it was nearby, and violently threw up her breakfast. Then again. God, how she hated herself as she knelt over the toilet bowl, nose filling with snot, tears streaming down her face. Shame, self-disgust, and humiliation washed over her in waves as she kept right on retching. Finally, she rose, staggered to the wash basin, washed and dried her face with paper towels, rinsed out her mouth, and hazarded a glance in the mirror. She looked like shit.
Pull yourself together, get back out there, and finish what you have to do.
Adjusting her hair, straightening her jacket, and putting on a fresh coat of lipstick, she emerged from the bathroom and walked stiffly back into the examiner's suite.
Agent Swanson, said Lime, coming forward with a concerned look. This isn't necessary at all. In fact,
I apologize, sir,
Corey said as coolly as she could. Then she turned to the ME.
Sorry, please proceed.
Of course, said Mason, looking as unperturbed as ever.
Corey had the impression this was nothing new to him, and it made her feel marginally better. The body, more precisely the upper part that remained in decent condition, had been thoroughly autopsied. Organs and brain removed, then stitched together in rough fashion. The cranium fastened back on sans brain, scalp wrinkling back from the bone and the eyes open. It was awful. But Corey steadied herself. There was nothing more to come up. Even the dry heaves had exhausted themselves.
As you can see, we did a complete medico-legal autopsy. In addition to examining all the organs, we did histological sections of the lungs, heart, brain, and liver, and a complete toxicological suite as well. The cause of death was clear. Asphyxiation caused by lack of oxygen and carbon monoxide poisoning, both exacerbated by smoke inhalation. Agent Morwood had a chronic, pre-existing condition, autoimmune lung disease, sometimes labeled interstitial lung disease. It's characterized by inflammation and scarring. He kept it under control with anti-inflammatories and corticosteroids, but his lungs were permanently damaged. The body was found in the front of the lab, and as you can see, it is only burned on the lower half. That burning occurred after death. The victim succumbed well before the fire reached him.
His voice was professional and soothing.
With his lung condition, even a small amount of carbon monoxide from the spreading fire would have incapacitated him. It might have happened even before he was aware there was a fire.
His lungs simply had no reserves. No cushion to deal with a drop in the oxygen levels or rise in smoke. He paused. Are there any questions so far? Corey mustered her voice.
You did histological sections of lung tissue?
Dr. Mason nodded.
May I see those?
Of course. He picked up a digital tablet, tapped it into life, brought up an image, then handed it to her.
You can clearly see the enlargement of the air spaces distal to the terminal bronchioles, accompanied by destruction of their walls, along with fibrosis, of course.
She could indeed see it. Inside the bronchioles, there was a scattering of soot and smoke particles, but not all that many.
That doesn't look like a lot of inhaled smoke, she said.
True. As I mentioned, he was probably affected first by carbon monoxide, as well as the rapid decrease in oxygen. The fire, after all, started in a rather small space. I would suggest he was unconscious by the time he actually began breathing smoke and succumbed not long after.
Thank you. She handed back the tablet. What did you find in the toxicology analysis?
Nothing. No sedatives, nothing that would incapacitate him, nothing that might indicate foul play. No alcohol or recreational drugs. He was clean.
Forgive the question, but any chance you could have missed anything?
There's always the remote possibility of an exotic or unknown compound being present. But we did the full suite of tests. And believe me, that covers just about everything, including nerve agents, radionuclides, and the other suspects, usual or unusual.
Corey forced herself to examine the body more closely. It smelled strongly of scorched hair and antiseptics. She felt another dry heave coming up, but managed to suppress it.
There's a scratch on his neck.
The ME bent over to look.
Yes, we noted that.
And?
It's a superficial mark and could have been caused by anything. Bodies almost always bear signs of minor injuries. A scratch here, a bruise there. Especially active males.
So it's not suspicious?
In the absence of other signs of struggle, no, we wouldn't normally find it significant.
Corey glanced at Lyme, saw the look of sympathy in his eyes. He must be thinking she was grasping at straws. Maybe she was.
Could I see his effects? She asked.
Certainly.
He turned and wheeled over another gurney. Morwood's clothes had been laid out upon it. Pretty much everything below the waist had been badly burned. The jacket, shirt, and tie were mostly intact, as with Morwood's body from the waist up. Resting next to these were his glasses, some scorched keys, the spine of a burnt wallet, and a mass of credit cards melted around a piece of notepaper, its bottom half burned away. Centered on the remaining top half was a single underlined word. Item.
Any idea what this is?
She asked, pointing at the piece of notepaper. Mason shook his head.
I assume it was the beginning of a list of some kind.
And there's no way to retrieve the rest of the list? To read the writing remaining in the ashes?
Sometimes that's possible, but not when it's as thoroughly consumed as this was.
Corey stared at the body, no longer horrified, but trying to extract some meaning, even some revelation. But there was nothing. What could have been on that list? Given the underlining, Morwood must have felt it highly significant. She wished to hell it hadn't burned.
Any other questions? Mason asked gently.
So there's no indication whatsoever this is a homicide.
Whether the fire was accidentally or deliberately set is outside my purview. But as far as cause of death is concerned, I am 100% sure this man died of suffocation due to a combination of carbon monoxide poisoning,
lack of oxygen, and smoke inhalation. The fire started in the back of the lab, and he was near the front entrance. And by the time he realized what was happening, he was either losing consciousness or already unconscious. He paused. He didn't feel any pain.
Thank you, Dr. Mason.
You're welcome, Agent Swanson.
As they left the office, Corey was relieved Lyme didn't bring up her getting sick. Instead, she herself brought up Nora's call the previous morning about the missing scientist, Baton. She'd intended to mention it during their initial meeting, but with everything else going on, it had fallen between the cracks.
Missing? Lyme said. Did she mention the circumstances?
He was about 5 miles north of their camp, looking for an outlying site, and vanished into the desert.
And they're concerned?
Not concerned so much as angry. From what I can tell, they suspect he was working for some other group, or possibly Israeli intelligence. And once he had what he wanted, he'd arranged to be picked up far from camp.
Anything else I should know?
Corey hesitated.
I spoke to Sheriff Homer Watts of Socorro County. I've worked with him before, and he seemed the right person to contact. He said he'd talked to the sheriff of Chavez County, where the dig's located, one Randall Buford. She didn't think Lyme needed to know she'd had breakfast with Watts a few hours earlier. As it was, he already knew more than he probably wanted to about that meal.
And how would you like to proceed?
I'd like to talk to Dr. Kelly again, Corey said. Get more information. Maybe we need to go back out there ourselves.
She found Lyme contemplating her with amused skepticism.
You sure that's the right course of action?
Corey looked back at him.
Do you really think a recent disappearance could be connected to a homicide from the 40s? If so, I'd like to hear your theory how.
She paused.
I see your point.
And what is my point?
That not everything is connected to everything else. This disappearance probably has nothing to do with the double homicide.
He smiled.
I'll never be the mentor Agent Morwood was, but I'm trying. That's exactly right. Since the disappearance of this Baton is almost certainly not connected to your case, and because it's merely a missing persons issue, it's been turned over to the rightful investigative body, the Chavez County Sheriff's Office. Turned over by you.
He looked at her, still smiling.
Very good work, Agent Swanson.
Thank you, sir.
And as they waited for the elevator, she tried to remember if Morwood had ever smiled at her.
40. Corey had never been to Los Alamos before, and she was curious to see the once secret city that had built the first atomic bomb. But when she finally got there, she found it just another generic government town, albeit one wedged into a fabulous setting of mountain peaks, ponderosa forests, and deep canyons. She stopped at a checkpoint and showed her credentials to the guard. She was given a special visitor's pass for one of the tech areas, where Dr. Eastchester had his office, along with directions on how to get there. The area lay outside of town, occupying a long mesa extending from the Jemez Mountains, surrounded by two sets of chain-link fences topped with concertina wire. She pulled up at another security station and showed her pass to the guard, who told her where to park and how to find Eastchester's office. The building had yet another guard at the entrance who checked her pass and ID again, then asked for her sidearm, which she surrendered. He escorted her down a long, cool hallway to an office at the end. Door open.
Dr. Eastchester, the guard said. Your visitor.
Corey entered a spacious and rather austere office overlooking a stand of pines, with views to snowy mountains beyond. A large blackboard dominated one wall, covered with scribbled equations.
You must be Special Agent Swanson, said an old man who rose somewhat creakily from a plush chair behind an old oaken desk piled with journals and papers.
Please don't get up, Dr. Eastchester, Corey said. But he did anyway and took her hand.
Pleased to meet you. Have a seat.
The scientist eased himself back down and she took a seat before the desk. He looked at her, a grave expression on his face.
I'm so awfully sorry to hear about Hale's death. I suspect you must have been quite close to him. I, too, felt close to him. This is a terrible shock.
Corey nodded, trying to keep her face from registering emotion at the man's sympathetic tone.
I'd known Hale since he was in your position. He had recently joined the FBI and was being mentored by a senior agent, Mickey Starr. You have my condolences.
Corey wanted to move the conversation as quickly as possible to firmer emotional ground.
Thank you for your sympathy. You have mine as well.
She took the opportunity to consult her notes.
You mentioned Agent Starr. What was he like?
He was a tough guy. Square-jawed, buzz cut, blue suits, clipped way of speaking. He was hard on Morwood, treated him roughly. To be honest, I didn't like him.
He paused to cough.
Don't know what's happened to Starr. Is he still around?
He passed away a few years ago, Corey said.
She had established that from older agents in the office. Eastchester nodded.
I understand Agent Morwood brought a device to you for identification.
Hearing this, Eastchester hesitated.
I know it's classified, said Corey. Don't be concerned. You can speak freely. I have clearance.
Very well.
Still, the man, obviously habituated to secrecy, waited a moment longer to answer.
As I explained to Hale, it's a device used to adjust the strength of a thermonuclear bomb by feeding more or less tritium fuel into the fusion chamber, nicknamed the Dial-A-Yield. At least one wag has joked the device set a bomb to either regular or extra crispy.
He gave a quick, weak smile.
Are you familiar with the basic principles behind the hydrogen bomb?
Corey wasn't, but didn't want to admit it.
Somewhat.
The fusion bomb is initiated by a fission bomb. That device determined the yield. I wasn't part of the development. It was years before my time. And in any case, it's no longer in use.
Corey jotted some notes.
Dr. Eastchester, what can you tell me about the case Agents Starr and Morwood were working on back then?
Quite a lot, actually. But doesn't the FBI have files on it?
We do. Some 20 feet of them. If you don't mind, I'd like to hear about it in your own words, since you were Agent Morwood's direct contact within Los Alamos.
I don't mind at all. It was strange. Have you ever read The Hollow Man by John Dixon Carr?
No, I haven't.
A chapter in the book deals with the many ways a person can commit the perfect murder in an apparently locked room. The case was like that, a locked room mystery. But, if I may ask, what does this have to do with the current case?
Probably nothing. I'm just trying to create some context.
Corey actually had wondered if the two cases might be connected. After all, despite the time factor, there was some overlap. But she knew not to say anything until she had hard evidence.
It's quite an easily described crime. That's one of the things that makes it so baffling. Its simplicity.
Corey waited while he took a deep breath, his eyes looking over her shoulder and into his own memory.
The victim was a senior scientist, a group leader, name of Arveson. Henrik Arveson. One morning, in January of 1999, his body was discovered in a high-security clean room within a secret area. The room was locked. It had a computerized device that recorded anyone who came in or out, not just by key code, but also by photograph and right index fingerprint. Arveson had been shot in the head at point-blank range. No one else was there. No gun was found in the room, so it could not have been suicide. And yet, the computerized record of ingress and egress showed he had entered the room alone at 9 the night before and never left. Nobody else entered or left the room until the staff arrived the next morning.
Could the security system have been hacked in some way?
That's what was initially supposed, but the most sophisticated analysis by computer security experts brought in from outside could find no trace of hacking. Believe me, the security of that room was, and still is actually, considered unhackable.
Who among the staff discovered the body?
Arveson's lab director, who also had a very high-level clearance. He saw from the record that Arveson had gone in at 9 and never came out, which was odd. So he went in and found the body.
Could the lab director have killed him when he went in? Another faint smile crossed the old man's face. He seemed to admire her doggedness.
Even if he'd managed to evade the security camera, Arveson's body temperature had declined too much. The ME placed the time of death around midnight.
Could you please tell me what Arveson did here?
He was group leader of the H-bomb nuclear chemistry department. The original H-bombs used pure tritium as a fuel, until it was discovered that tritium could be combined with lithium to make a compound called lithium-6-deuteride. When bombarded with neutrons by a triggering explosion, it creates a vast amount of tritium, which in turn becomes fuel for the second stage of the explosion. Lithium-7 proved even more effective under certain conditions.
He paused.
That's probably as much detail as I should get into. Let's just say that Arveson's team was always looking for better fuels for the H-bomb. This was extremely classified work. Eventually, it rendered the dial-a-yield device Morwood showed me obsolete. That only worked with compressed tritium gas, dating from the super program of the greenhouse tests in, 1951. The later H-bomb fuels were all solids.
I see.
Corey hesitated, then asked,
Can you think of any reason why someone might want to kill Agent Morwood?
At this, Eastchester's eyebrows shot up.
There's a possibility he was murdered?
No,
Corey quickly backtracked.
It seems clear it was an accident, but it's a question we always ask, you know, routine.
She hoped that would satisfy him.
I can't think of any reason. A good FBI agent must have a lot of enemies, no? The people he's put away, their families and associates, that sort of thing. But I personally don't know of anyone who might have done him harm.
He paused.
The problem with Arveson's case was an almost complete lack of evidence. They recovered the bullet and its casing, and that was about it. The area showed no signs of unauthorized entry. Arveson was very well liked, with no obvious enemies. The fact was, he appeared to be an unusually forthright, ethical and straightforward individual. Every single person who had access to the high-security room that night, and there weren't that many, had an alibi. A good alibi. Morwood and Star came up against a brick wall almost right away and banged their heads against it for, oh, it must have been years, without success.
The old scientist shook his head sadly. As Corey left the secure area and drove down the winding road from Los Alamos, her mind drifted back to the burned lab at her own office. The sight and smell of the soggy, acrid place, in the ghostly glow of her flashlight, would be etched into her mind forever. Her forensic drawings, dental x-rays, diagrams, and data were safely inside the computer network, where no fire could touch them. But they were incomplete. The dental records were also in the cloud, of course. But so far, nothing had come from them. The homicide victims themselves were reduced almost to ash, and her reconstructions had been completely destroyed. Without intact skulls, she could not redo them. How was she going to identify the victims now? Still, there was the dial-a-yield device. Now that she knew what it was, those numbers stamped on it might be serial numbers that could lead somewhere. Exactly where, she had no idea. 41. Nora felt a surge of excitement as she looked over the site. As soon as the road was finished, Nora had hopped in a jeep with Emilio and Skip, and they'd arrived at the Los Gigantes Buttes a little past noon. It was a far more evocative place than where they'd been excavating before, and as an added benefit, there was less wind here in the valley. The sandstone buttes stood here and there on the plain, glowing red in the noonday sun. As she looked over the area, Nora couldn't see any signs of the old 1947 disturbance. It was a tribute to the power of LIDAR that the site could be seen so plainly from the air. She wondered again, was it actually possible that an alien spaceship crashed here? She had to admit that the evidence continued to pile up. She had a feeling the excavation she was about to embark upon would decide the matter once and for all. The thought filled her with both excitement and anxiety.
So, what's the plan?
Asked Skip, looking around, hands on hips.
A ground survey,
said Nora.
Then we'll grid out the area and start digging.
She was pretty sure that before the end of the day, Tappan would show up. By the time he got there, she wanted him to see that she'd made good progress.
Let's get going.
The three of them walked the site slowly from one side to the other and back again, examining the ground for any surface artifacts. It took an hour, and they turned up almost nothing beyond a single rusted tin of chewing tobacco. It was time to grid the site. Nora and Skip hauled out supplies from the jeep, including wooden stakes and day-glow twine. Vigil set up the theodolite while Skip held the stadia rod for him and Nora gave directions, and in another hour the area had been gridded in precise, GPS-delineated squares. At that moment, Nora saw a corkscrew of dust on the horizon. A few minutes later, Tappan arrived. He stepped out of the jeep with a big smile and looked over the gridded site.
This is what I call progress, he said.
Despite herself, Nora felt a glow of pleasure.
You're just in time to watch us break ground.
That was my hope.
Starting with the first square meter, Nora and Vigil gently dug out bunches of grass and set them aside, then began the serious work of removing the sandy soil, layer by layer. Tappan watched from a shade they had set up next to the excavation, from time to time speaking into the base camp radio. It was quick, easy going, as Nora expected it would be in ground that had already been dug and backfilled before, even if many decades ago. She and Vigil worked the grids as Skip tossed the excavated sand through two sets of screens, for large and small items respectively. As the hours went by, they encountered nothing but undifferentiated sand, nor did anything turn up in the screening. The site appeared to be clean, suspiciously clean. There weren't even the usual random stones. As the afternoon lengthened, Tappan suddenly called out,
"Nora, may I see you a moment?"
She climbed out of the hole and came over.
"I just spoke to Cecilia," Tappan said. "She and Kuznetsov have been going over the LiDAR point cloud using image enhancement, and they found something else. A disturbance that looks a lot more recent. I asked Cecilia to bring out the charts for us to look at."
Sure enough, 20 minutes later, another cloud of dust appeared on the horizon. Soon, Toph pulled up in a jeep and retrieved a document tube from the passenger seat. She brought it over, red hair stirring in the light wind. They all retreated to chairs under the shade.
"Thanks for coming out," said Tappan.
"No problem."
Toth slid a survey out of the tube and unrolled it on the table.
"We've been manipulating the point cloud data," she said. "Take a look at what we found. It's up in the corner, here."
About a mile and a half from where they were now working, Nora could see a blurry set of tire tracks entering from the west and winding through the foothills of the Los Fuertes Mountains before heading out of the survey area to the north.
"Here's a closer view."
Toph unrolled a second chart. The tracks came in from the left side of the survey, ran east through the Gigantes Valley in the foothills, and stopped at a point near the far edge of the survey area. Here, they appeared to move around in a few erratic circles before turning and heading away in a different direction.
"These are fresh tracks," said Toph. "Very fresh. I think what we might be looking at is where Baton got picked up."
Nora nodded.
"Not only are they recent," said Toph, "but what's more, it looks like an attempt was made to brush them out. They probably weren't anticipating a sub-centimeter LiDAR survey."
She whisked out a third chart.
"This view has been further enhanced."
Nora peered closely and felt a chill travel up her spine. There was a vague confusion of tracks, both car and foot, evidently brushed out but still visible.
"Those tracks lead into the mountains to the north, but where exactly?"
"We don't know, and it may be hard to find out."
"Why?"
"That's where the airspace is closed. The old Pershing Proving Range, a long-abandoned military base, off-limits to ground entry, too."
Tappan gave a low whistle.
"I'm not normally paranoid, but it's enough to make you wonder. Baton vanishing, and those tracks going into an abandoned base? Supposedly. I mean, what's in there? Area 52? Can we fly our drone over and take a look?"
"No," said Toph. "Unless you want to lose your drone license."
"What about Google Earth?"
"I checked it out. Just shows some abandoned buildings. No sign of anything recent."
No one spoke for a moment. Toth said,
"Another thing. Two sheriffs showed up in base camp this afternoon, investigating Baton's disappearance. They want to speak to you, Mr. Tappan, and Skip."
"Christ, just what we need," said Tappan.
He turned to Nora.
"Let's wrap up here and go see what they want. It's quitting time anyway."
42. Late in the afternoon, as Corey passed by the door of Morwood's old office, now occupied by Lime, the senior agent called out,
"Agent Swanson?"
She backed up and paused. Lime was sitting behind his desk, the chief fire investigator in a chair opposite with a file open in front of him.
"Come in," said Lime. "Have you met Lawrence Sfeeney?"
"Yes," said Corey, as Sfeeney stood and extended his hand. He had questioned her early in the investigation,
She felt a tightening in her chest. Please sit down. They all sat, and Lyme leaned forward on his elbows, looking first at Corey, then at Feeny.
Let's get straight to the point, shall we? I mean, as it concerns Agent Swanson.
Right.
Feeny turned to her.
We determined the source of the fire. It was a short circuit in the autoclave. In other words, said Lyme, not the Bunsen burner, as Lathrop suggested.
We found the burner in the off position, Feeny added.
Disconnected, and the gas cock at the source turned off as well.
Although none of this was a surprise to Corey, she nevertheless felt a wave of relief wash over her.
Furthermore, Feeny said, our investigation showed that the autoclave had not been properly maintained. The lab's sprinkler and smoke detector system were inoperable because of chewed wires, a rodent infestation that went undetected. That fire suppression system, of course, is supposed to be tested regularly. On two recent occasions, Lathrop asked the inspectors to come back another time when he was not busy. And as a result, the system had not been tested within the prescribed schedule. Finally, the fire was accelerated by stacks of unopened packages, boxes, and deliveries that had been allowed to accumulate in the front hall of the lab.
As chief of the lab, Lyme added, Lathrop had responsibility for all these issues.
Corey was stunned by these last pieces of information. It took her a moment to process them, and then suddenly she felt a wave of anger at Lathrop's carelessness.
What's going to be done? Corey asked. I mean, Agent Morwood's death was Lathrop's fault.
He'll be given an engraved plaque and retired.
That's it?
Lyme looked at her.
I understand your anger. I feel it too. But Lathrop didn't do anything criminal. These were a cascade of oversights that, taken together, combined to make an unlikely tragedy.
Corey swallowed and said nothing further. It felt like manslaughter.
The worst thing he did, Lyme said, was blame you. Your fellow agents feel that pretty keenly, a lab technician casting blame on one of their own. The SAC has asked Lathrop to take his remaining vacation days starting tomorrow, then move directly into retirement. We won't see him around here again.
Corey nodded. She still felt a burning sensation. It was so unfair. By all rights, Lathrop should be locked up. On the other hand, she realized Lyme had arranged this brief discussion to give her some closure, even if incomplete. And for that, she was grateful.
Thank you, Agent Feeny, said Lyme.
The fire investigator rose and left. Lyme waited until he was gone before speaking again.
I know this is a lot for you to handle right now, but it's important to move forward, and I'm confident you agree. So, tell me how the case is going. I understand you interviewed Dr. Eastchester this morning.
Corey made a mental effort to get back into the groove of the case. She told Lyme about the visit and explained she'd be sending the serial number of the strange device to Quantico for tracing. She hadn't yet made further progress on the dental records, but hoped to find time for that in the very near future, and she decided to conduct the search herself rather than delegate it. Lyme listened intently, nodding, then congratulated her on the excellent work.